to Acts 25. Now, just a little note. Tonight, we're going to continue our look at the implications of Christ's soon return. Last week, we saw the kind of actions that ought to describe us, that ought to fill our lives if we believe that Jesus Christ is coming soon. Tonight, what we'd like to do is look at the attitudes that ought to characterize our life if we believe that Jesus Christ is coming soon. But this morning, we want to look at Acts 25. And we want to get back to our theme concerning persecution. Have you ever thought that when we invite people to trust in Jesus and get saved, there's a part of us that might be saying, but you really don't want to do this? Because you really don't know what you're in for. When I hear preachers, particularly on television, talking about, come to Jesus and all your problems will be solved, I say, really? Can you give me a verse on that? In fact, we know that when you come to Jesus, you get three big new problems, don't you? Called the devil, the world system in which we live, and your own sin nature. And they will do everything they can to make life miserable. But that world system is what we're looking at right now when we talk about persecution. We have a world system that's not a friend of grace, not a friend of Christians. You saw this just a couple of weeks ago. A man strapped with explosives walked into a park in Pakistan, walked over deliberately to the playground, and homicidally ignited the bomb. He killed 74 people and injured over 100 more, and half of the 74 that were killed were children. You know their crime? You know why he attacked them? They were Christians celebrating Easter with a special thing in the park. Some Christians, no doubt, are behind the law that was passed in Texas just before the Supreme Court decision about same-sex marriage to protect pastors under the law from having to violate their faith in order to obey the Supreme Court's dictate. And remember, what the Supreme Court did was not make a law, although that's what they'd like to think they did. The same thing is being done in Florida. And a man said, we have no need for this law. Pastors are protected under the Constitution. Yeah, we've seen how that worked, haven't we? How's that working out? So the folks behind the Florida law are pushing for it still. A similar law is being crafted in Louisiana, and one has already gone to the legislature in Ohio. And a similar law was passed with no negative votes in the House of Georgia. Every legislator voted in favor of a pastor protection law. And people like the NBA and the NFL and major corporations threatened the governor, and he vetoed it. All the law said basically was that a pastor did not have to violate his beliefs and hold a same-sex marriage. Nobody could force him to do that. The governor in North Carolina apparently has a backbone, unlike the governor in Georgia. I don't know how the governor in Georgia stands up without a backbone, but that's another subject. There they passed a law that said transgenders, bisexuals, etc., whoever you are, you must use the bathroom that matches your birth certificate. Again, the NFL, the NBA, and all scores of organizations, corporations have threatened North Carolina. And the governor signed it into law. You see, the LGBT movement does not want equality. They want you silenced and you agree with them. You must condone what they're doing. Now, I am not for discriminating against anybody. But at the same time, why must we change all the bathrooms? Why must we have women exposed to men coming into their bathroom when that man will not be harmed at all by going into the men's bathroom? But people like Christians who stand up for biblical rights are in trouble, aren't they? And folks, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to get worse. So preparing for persecution is a pretty good idea. Now that's where we are in Acts 25. We've just finished hearing number 2. We had hearing number 1 under Felix. Paul was exonerated. Felix found nothing wrong with him and kept him in prison anyway. Why? Satisfy the Jews. And to satisfy his own morbid curiosity, because he'd pull Paul out every once in a while and they'd have discussions. Felix finally bit the dust as the governor, as the procurator of that area, because of his wicked dealings. Nero got rid of him and replaced him with Festus. Now, when Festus came, Festus was not a slave-turned-governor. He was a politician and a philosopher. And Festus immediately took grip of the situation. He was there just a short time. He immediately went up to Jerusalem, got with the Jewish leaders, found out what the problem was, went back and dealt with Paul. Had them come down. Of course, they wanted Paul to come up. And we know why, don't we? They wanted to waylay him along the way and kill him. But in verse 3 of Acts 25, they make it very clear that they want Festus to have him put to death. The same thing will be said at the very end of this chapter. We want Paul put to death. Put to death for not having violated one single solitary Roman law. As Festus will say in a little while, the only thing he's really guilty of is believing in this superstition or this religious dogma similar to the Jews but enough different that it upsets the Jews, and particularly that there's a Jesus, and we know Jesus died, but Paul apparently believes he's alive. Silly Paul. And that's where we are. Paul's still in prison to placate the Jews. Because remember, we're at the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s A.D. In 66 A.D., the Zealots will lead the residents of Jerusalem to rebel against Roman rule. So, Felix and Festus are already feeling the rumblings. So they want to do whatever they can to kind of hold down the situation. You don't want things going bad on your watch. So they're doing whatever they can to placate the Jews to keep them quiet and happy. But in 66, they rebel anyway. Now they're dealt with by two generals. I'll mention this because it'll be important later. The first general to come was a man by the name of Vespasian. Vespasian and his army came to put down the rebellion. Now, it took a little while to put it down. And Nero was dethroned, and they needed a new emperor, so they made Vespasian the new emperor. So Vespasian had to go back to Rome. And so his son, Titus then became the general and led the forces. And it was Titus who eventually put down the rebellion and brought Jerusalem back under Rome's thumb in 70 AD. It took them 4 years. So you can imagine that Festus, feeling the rumblings of all this, is trying to do the best he can by the Jews. But he has a problem. Right at the end of the hearing, this crazy Paul says, "I appeal to Caesar." See, that became a problem on a regular basis. Paul was a Roman citizen. And Roman citizens could do that. Remember, it happened back in Philippi. They got all scared because they had flogged a Roman citizen, which was illegal. But they didn't know Paul was a Roman citizen. They did everything they can. They were falling over themselves. "Please, Paul," you know, we would say today they were trying to not get sued. There they were trying to not get killed. Okay? So Paul, as a Roman citizen, could appeal to Caesar. Plus, there were two things working. One, he wasn't getting anywhere fast. And of course, Festus wanted him to go up to Jerusalem. He knew he wasn't going to get anywhere there. Those Jewish authorities were not going to change their mind. So there was no point in it. Plus, there's a good chance that he knew about the plot, since it wasn't the first one. Actually, it was the third one that had been hatched against him. Secondly, in Acts 23:11, what did God promise Paul? "You're going to stand in Rome." So Paul says, "I can fulfill that promise. I'll appeal to Rome. No problem. God wants me there anyway. No big deal." So that's where we are when we come down to verse 13. Now, this section is hearing number 3. And hearing number 3 will go all the way to the end of chapter 26. We are not going there today. We can't cover all that space today. We'll take a couple, 3 weeks here to do that. But today we want to look at, first of all, the players. Who's here? Who we got working? Verse 13. "After certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came unto Caesarea to salute Festus." Remember, Festus has just been here a short while. Now, King Agrippa comes to pay a call. It's a courtesy call. "Welcome to the area, Festus." Now remember Festus, we've kind of outlined him. He's the frustrated Roman. He's the guy that's tried to figure out what to do with Paul and can't. Now, please note, in both chapter 24 and here in chapter 25, Felix and Festus came to the same conclusion about Paul that Pontius Pilate came to about Jesus. "I find no fault in him." But he's frustrated now because Paul's appealed to Caesar and he's got to deal with it. So in step King Agrippa and Bernice. Now this is an interesting pair. First of all, King Agrippa is a king in figurehead only. He's got about as much power as Queen Elizabeth does. Okay? You know what Queen Elizabeth's main power is? To officiate at official functions and stay out of the way and drain the taxpayers' dollars. That's pretty much it. And to give people, children and grandchildren, for the whole world to stop and look at. I know they had the wedding on television. I'm sure people in this room were fixed watching it. I'm like, who cares? I was at a wedding once. It was mine to my wife. That was the best wedding I've ever been to. I've been at quite a few weddings since then. I thought they were pretty cool too. But a prince and a future princess, But it was pretty big stuff there. That's who King Agrippa is. King Agrippa has been declared king of this section. He's called, they're sometimes called tetrarchs because they have a quarter of the section that used to be the first King Herod section. But he's been placed there by Rome. His one power is over the temple. He gets to appoint the high priest. That's pretty much it. Otherwise, it's all pomp and circumstance. It's all show. Now, who is King Agrippa? Well, he's a Herod. But he's not the first Herod. The first Herod we run into is Herod the Great. And you may remember him from wise men fame. Remember what Herod the Great did? He was so great, he killed all the children, all the male children, 2 years of age and younger. Wow, that is great. Pretty impressive. The next Herod to come along was Herod Antipas. Now you may remember Herod Antipas. Herod was the one that mocked Jesus. Jesus came before him. Now Archelaus was between those two, but Herod Antipas was one of my... And Herod was the one that had John the Baptist beheaded. Wow. This Herod Agrippa in this section's got a real family tree, doesn't he? Oh, we aren't done yet. Herod Antipas had the first Herod Agrippa. Herod Agrippa the first as his son. Herod Agrippa the first is the one that had James put in jail and Peter put in jail. He killed James, was going to kill Peter, didn't get it done. But before Peter got killed, Herod gave a speech. Everybody lauded him as God. He received it and God killed him. But he had three kids. Herod Agrippa the second and two daughters. Drusilla, who was the wife of Felix. We've already met her. Wait till you hear the other daughter's name. Bernice. Who came to visit Festus? Herod Agrippa the second and Bernice, his consort. Yep. He was having a relationship with his sister. By the way, she didn't always stay with Herod. She was the mistress of Emperor Vespasian. And then she jilted him for Titus, his son. And then she came back to Herod. She got around. In verse 13, it's King Agrippa and Bernice. In verse 23, it's King Agrippa and Bernice. And in fact, at the end, when they stand up to make the ruling, it's King Agrippa and Bernice. Before the great white throne, it's going to be King Agrippa and Bernice. And cast into the lake of fire, it'll be King Agrippa and Bernice. I heard a preacher once say, I don't know why anybody would name their child Bernice. And then he stopped himself and goes, well, if you did, maybe you can get it changed. I don't know why anybody named their child Festus, but did you know that Festus Ezeli is the backup center for the Golden State Warriors? And we all remember Festus from Matt Dillon days. Bernice is the reminder of the wickedness of King Agrippa and Bernice. She is the foul reminder of who these people are. Now, folks, let's note something. It's no better today. Have you seen our presidential candidates? We got our choice between a crook, a crazy man, and a carny, and a Cruz. I mean, a little scary, isn't it?
just kind of wonder what's happening to our country. When those are the choices we have for president. But it's a reminder. The people who sit in Washington and the people who sit in Harrisburg do not have any great love for the things of Christ. And that love is what little interest they might have is waning day by day. It will be no better for us before them than it was for Paul before Agrippa and Bernice, or Paul before Festus, or Paul before Felix, or Jesus before Pontius Pilate. It's not going to be. Now that might be a bit of a downer to you, but nevertheless, it is a reminder that those are the kind of people we're going to see. And then the fourth one we have is the faithful representative of God by the name of Paul. Little, unassuming Paul. Those are the players in our drama. Now there's a problem that's being dealt with in our drama, and we see that starting in verse 14 down to verse 22. Notice he says, there's a certain man left behind in bonds by the name of Paul. And he says, I went up to the priests and the elders, verse 15, and found out they wanted a judgment against him. And we know what that judgment was. They wanted him dead. And verse 16, to whom I answered, it is not the manner of Romans to deliver any man to die without an accusation. Remember, Festus, for all of his bad points, is still a Roman politician who follows Roman law. Roman law is rule. Romans don't mess with it. Especially Roman politicians, if they want to keep their office, aren't going to mess with it. Notice he says, we don't deliver any man to die before that which is the accused gets to face his accusers face to face. He has an opportunity to answer for himself, verse 16. And they came, and I sat on the judgment seat, and commanded the man to be brought forth. And verse 18, against whom when the accuser stood up, they brought none of the accusations of the things that I supposed. What Festus is saying is when the whole matter came to a head, and I heard what they had to say, I'm like, why are you bringing this to me? Issues of religious observance are not under Roman law. That's not my department. I don't rule over those things. In fact, Gallio had already set the precedent back in Acts 18 when he said, if we're talking about questions of religion, get out of here. Go deal with it yourself. But you know why the Jewish leaders didn't want to do that, don't you? They couldn't put Paul to death. Festus could. They had no right of execution. Festus did. But notice he says, verse 20, and because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem to be judged. But then Paul appealed to be reserved under the hearing of Augustus. And I commanded him to be kept till I might send him to Caesar. Now, there's a little problem here. When a higher court rules on a lower court's ruling, there must be a ruling. There's been no ruling. Furthermore, there must be some communication between the lower court to the higher court. We still do that today. This is not, unfamiliar to us. Higher courts don't rule on situations that didn't happen in the lower courts. There's a system you go through. Paul's gone through that system. Now he's run into a problem. He needs to go to Caesar, to Augustus. It's interesting, the word sabbatus, which is used here, speaks of one who is revered. It's a hint at the emperor worship. The way we get Augustus is that the Greek word in Latin is August, Augustus or August. When someone is august, that means they're venerated or reverend. Now, when Festus talks about Caesar, he'll call him Lord, Kurios, which is generally referring to Jesus as a title of deity as well. And Paul appealed to go to Caesar, and Agrippa said, okay, I tell you what I'll do. I'll hear him. Now, Festus had this in mind. Notice verse 26, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord, wherefore I have brought him before you. Now, by the way, that you is plural. You can't see it, but it's plural. He's talking to the whole assembled group. And especially you, singular, King Agrippa. Now, why would he want King Agrippa to help him? Because King Agrippa was Jewish. He was Idumean, but of Jewish descent. And he was the king that dealt with the Jewish affairs. He had knowledge of Judaism. Festus listened to all this stuff and is like, duh, what is this all about? Who is this Paul, and what are these laws, and what is this guy that's supposed to be dead and now alive? No doubt he knew of Jesus. He probably heard of him, probably heard of the case with Pontius Pilate, but he didn't know anything about Jesus. Certainly didn't know anything about the resurrection. And so he says, okay, I tell you what, why don't we get together? So King Agrippa says, we'll do it the next day. Now, notice what happens the next day. This is the cool part. We've got the players. We've got the problem. But now comes the providence. Now, providence is God's sovereignty worked out into everyday life. We say, well, that happened by divine providence. What we're saying is that was God's sovereign will worked out in everyday living. And we're going to see this. We're going to see this right here. Notice what happens. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp. By the way, you know what the Greek word is for pomp? It is fantasia. Any of you remember a Disney movie like that? Fantasia? It's all leading to another word called fantasy. Fantasies are great things in the mind that never happen in reality. These people are great. Great Festus, Roman ruler. Great King Agrippa. His consort, the wonderful Bernice. And not just that. Notice who else is there in this divinely assembled gathering, divinely arranged gathering. You see, God has engineered this. It's all divinely arranged. Now notice who's coming together. It says, and was entered into the place of hearing, basically an auditorium, with the chief captains. The Greek word is kiliarchs. There were five consorts at Caesarea. That means five 1,000-man units of military. Over each one of those 1,000 men was a kiliarch, a ruler of 1,000. We would say a general, or perhaps a colonel. So you've got these five units of 1,000 men with five rulers, five military commanders. And you can imagine, if there's all this pomp that King Agrippa and Bernice are in, imagine how these guys are dressed. They've got their best duds on, don't they?
They are dressed to the hilt with their uniforms. They've got all the medals. They've got all the regalness of a military man. Then, notice who else is there.
King Agrippa was present with the chief captains. And then notice the next one is the principal men of the city.
The men who were something. The term has the idea of those who are the premier, the privileged, the elite, the men of par excellence. In other words, the bigwigs of the city. You got your mayor, you got your town council, you got your corporation heads, you got all these sort of guys. And they're probably dressed to the hilt too, because they don't want to look bad. This is a black tie event, guys. You know, and the gals are in their gowns. I mean, this is the hottest ticket in town. Anybody who's anybody will be there. Now, they think it's really cool that they're all getting together and they're going to hear this ball. But we're sitting there going, can you see God's hand? Could Paul have spoken to these people any other way? If he had gone to them one by one, how long would it have taken him? And would he have even had access to some of these people? And yet, in this large auditorium, thanks to King Agrippa and Bernice, here they are! So we've got divinely arranged, divinely assembled. We got people we would never have a chance to reach otherwise in this place. And they're divinely aroused, aren't they? They want to hear Paul. Now think of it. How do you suppose King Agrippa was clothed? I'm thinking crown, jewels, long robe. Bernice, maybe crown, jewels, long robe. We got those five kiliarchs, regally attired as head soldiers. We got all the prominent men, their black ties, and of course their wives are there with their best gowns. Festus, no doubt, has the dress that accompanies his office as governor. There they all are. And then they bring in this guy named Paul. Now, first of all, we know that Paul's not a really big guy. Kind of a scrawny little guy. 2 Corinthians 10:10 says he's nothing to look at. He's kind of weak. Where's he coming from? He's coming from basically a prison cell, not completely a prison cell. He's being held in a room there. But I wonder, when was the last time he bathed? When was the last time he put on something new? We don't know. It's not like he had a whole lot of time to plan. They decided one day to do it the next day. Probably in sandals. You got this little wimpy guy there. And all these regal people. Talk about being outgunned. How many people in the world ever think about Festus? How many of the people in the world ever think about King Agrippa? How many people in the world ever think about Bernice? How many people in the world think about Paul? You see, that's why it's fantasy. Folks, the world lives in fantasy. They think they've got the world by the tail. They don't realize what comes out on that end.
It's all fantasy. Everything's right. Everything's good. I've got my house. I've got my car. I got more than one car. I've got the summer home in Delaware or on the beach. You know, I've got this and that and the other thing. Remember, he who dies with the most toys wins. Nothing. And it's all fantasy. The scrubby little guy with nothing to wear, he's the one who is revered for a lifetime, for many lifetimes. 2,000 years later, we're still talking about him, and nobody gives a hoot about Festus, Agrippa, or Bernice. If you know Jesus Christ, in 10,000 years from now, you'll still be before the throne of God as one of his chosen children. You won't be with Agrippa, you won't be with Bernice, and you won't be with Festus. Lost and gone forever. What a contrast. But what a setup. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 26, you know what Paul's going to do? He's going to give him his testimony. You're going to see in chapter 26 the power of a testimony. You remember last quarter when I taught in our Sunday school class about personal evangelism, I said, prepare your testimony. Why? Because your testimony is a powerful thing. What God has done in your life is a powerful thing, which no one can deny. If your life reflects Christ, your life then is the stamp, as it were, on the truthfulness of God's Word. You're the proof in the pudding. You're the guarantee that what God said is true. Like that song says, what he's done for others, he can do for you. It's no secret what God can do. So Paul's going to do that. He's going to give his testimony to all this assembled entourage of the who's who's and what's what. All arranged by God sovereignly to occur. God put it all together. Now, has Paul suffered while he's been there in Caesarea? Yeah. Has Paul's freedom been limited? You got it. Have things not gone the way Paul might have envisioned them? For sure. But is God using Paul? Does Paul have reason to rejoice? You have to read between the lines. You don't see this in either the Greek, Hebrew, or English. But as Paul was walking from the prison up to the auditorium, he was going, yes, 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 yes. Is this good or what? They're going to ask him to give his testimony. Paul, you've got the floor. Tell us whatever you want to tell us. Remember, Cornelius did that same thing. Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, he says, well, we're all here. Lay it on us. Tell us. I got all my friends, all my neighbors here. Now tell us what God's told you to tell us. And Peter goes, whoosh, and a whole bunch of people got saved that day. Now, we don't have any record of anybody coming to know Christ from what Paul's doing, but can you see the hand of God preparing these people to hear the gospel? And perhaps many of them did come to faith in Christ. When we get to heaven, we'll have to check that out, won't we? Now, the neat thing is that Paul's not legally bound to be there. He doesn't have to come. He's already appealed to Caesar. He doesn't need to go to this thing. If you were his lawyer, you'd probably say, no, look, Paul, don't go. Don't go. Because they might find something, you'll say something and they'll use it against you. Don't go. You don't have to go. Paul's like, don't go.
This is what I prayed for. I've waited 2 years in confinement for this day.
Now, let's remind ourselves of some applications that we need to make to our lives. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2 says that the people in this world walk according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. Now, who does the prince of the power of the air hate most? Us. He hates Christians. And if these people who are not Christians, who sit in judges' seats, are walking according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, who's giving the orders and what can we expect? When it goes well for us, we should thank God that he overruled what was going to happen. We should expect it. Tonight we're going to read in 1 Peter, don't be astonished at the astonishing things that are coming your way. Secondly, let us remember about worldliness. These folks are so comfortable in this world. It's going well for them. But remember what John said in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 17. The world is passing away and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abides forever. All that you see around you, including the people who don't know Christ, are going into the fire. Only those who are right with Jesus Christ will be exempt. So then, you're tempted to be a part of this world system. Say no, you don't want to be a part of it. Thirdly, let us remember about providence. Let's remember about providence. Ephesians 1:11 says, God worketh all things according to the counsel of his own will. God engineered this, as God engineers every part of our lives. What a wonderful thing to know that God does all things according to the counsel of his own will. Psalm 115 verse 3 says, everything that he pleased, he did. God is in control and we can trust him. Fourthly, let's think about evangelism. Sadly, some Christians have never talked to another person about the need to receive Jesus Christ as Savior. You've never had that opportunity. You know why you've never had that opportunity? Because you've never looked for it. We need to look for it. We need to expect it. We need to be ready. I carry in my pocket here, Monday through Friday, a little wallet. It's a former date book. And in it I have my tracts. And you know, Friday night I went into Walmart. I went into Redner's. You know what I did? I opened that thing up, pulled out a couple of tracts I thought I'd like to use, put my wallet back in and slid the tracts into my pocket so I could easily get them out and give them away. Friday when we went to lunch, again, the same thing. I was going to give a tip. Now, please, if you're going to give a tip and put a tract with it, give a really good tip. Oh, wow. I got a tract and a quarter. Wow. They spent $25 on lunch and I get 25 cents. Yeah. Well, I want to read this. But if they're expecting $5 and you give six or seven or something like that, and then give the track, maybe they'll give you a hearing. But you go in intending to do that, don't you? You don't sit there at the meal and go, oh, I ought to give a track when we're done here. I forgot my tract. You carry them with you. You get ready. When you know you're going to meet somebody, you plan to talk to them about Jesus. You walk away discouraged if you don't get the opportunity. Not walking away going, oh, I had an opportunity, I should have taken it. Go in expecting. What was Paul expecting to do when he came up? He was expecting to use this situation to preach the gospel. In fact,
He's not going to preach anything new. Same old story. In fact, if these people have been following Paul's previous hearings, they go, that's exactly what he said the last time. Don't you have any new messages?
But he was ready to preach the gospel. We need to be ready to preach the gospel. Folks, persecution's coming. Let's get ready. And let's use it to the glory of God. We're going to have opportunities like we've never had before. Because when do you see the most stars? When it's the darkest. The lights of Christ will shine even brighter as the days grow darker in our country and in our world. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the privilege of